Hey, Dr. Barbara Blackburn is back, and this time she's talking to us about her book, Rigor and Assessment in the Classroom. A lot to learn today. Enjoy.
You are listening to Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12, a podcast for educators, helping you help kids achieve their dreams. Now here's Steve with this week's show.
Dr. Barbara Blackburn has dedicated her life to raising the level of rigor and motivation for professional educators and students alike. What separates Barbara from others is that her 18 books are focused on providing concrete examples that are easy to understand and use in the classroom. A few of her book titles are Rigor Made Easy, Getting Started, Rigorous Schools and Classrooms, Leading the Way, Rigor in Your Classroom, A Toolkit for Teachers, Literacy from A to Z, Rigor for Students with Special Needs, Motivating Struggling Learners, 10 Ways to Build Student Success, and others. But I have to mention my all-time favorite one. This title just is awesome. Rigor is Not a Four-Letter Word, second edition. I love that title.
Stephen, the third edition comes out in about 3 weeks, March of 2018. So we just revised it again based on feedback. So third edition is coming out next.
Awesome. Congratulations on that. That's too cool, Barbara. She has dedicated her life to helping teachers improve their work with children and students of all ages. Barbara has been a teacher, a professor, and now an educational consultant. She often can be found working with teachers and administrators in workshops as well as presenting at state and national conferences. Today we are focused on Barbara's latest book, Rigor and Assessment in the Classroom. And it's only latest by a few weeks, right?
Right.
But once again, we're focused on Rigor and Assessment in the Classroom. Please welcome Dr. Barbara Blackburn to the show. Say hi to everyone, Barbara.
Hi, I'm so happy to be here and really to return and do this again.
This is awesome to have you back. And so welcome back. And, you know, we talked back at episode 51 about your book, Rigor Made Easy. And I also got a chance to watch you work with teachers and administrators and learning how to become more rigorous in the classroom and school. So what I would like to do is start with this question. What do you think is the biggest misunderstanding about rigor and the classroom?
I think the biggest misunderstanding, and this happens whether it's teachers, leaders, students, or parents, is that rigor means more. You're more rigorous if you're sending home double the homework. You're more rigorous if they're doing 25 multiple choice problems instead of one in-depth essay. The notion of quantity being higher than quality. And then right up there with it is the myth that, well, if we make it more or if we make it harder, then the students should just get there by themselves. And when you really look at what rigor means, it's a combination of three things. Rigor is about having high expectations, providing the support to match those high expectations, and then students demonstrating learning at a high level. And so often that support piece is lost. I know I spoke with one teacher. She said, you know, I teach honors students, and if they can't do it on their own, then they shouldn't be in an honors class. And my response to her was, do you remember your first year of teaching? And she said, oh, yeah. And I said, did you ever need help? And she said, yeah, I struggled some that year. And I said, you were doing something rigorous and you needed support to get there. Why are your students any different?
And was there a space, a gap? In-
she didn't say anything after that. No, she didn't.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Because that's really what it is. And, you know, anytime we are doing something that is rigorous, we need help. And I don't understand where we got the idea that students weren't going to need support. And frankly, if you sort of strip everything else away, rigor is about taking a student where they are and moving them to a new, higher place. And, you know, that's why I got into education. And that's why I think most teachers got into teaching. But somehow that's gotten lost in the word rigor, and we need to be rigorous.
You're so right. That's, you know, that is one of those things that the idea of thinking that it's just more of something, or, you know, more in a shorter period of time. That's what. And there's a lot of misconceptions about that. So I appreciate you sharing that. So who is the target audience for rigor and assessment in the classroom, and why?
Well, I think the main audience is certainly teachers, because it's designed to be things that you can take and change in your classroom. How can you adapt something? How can you implement something? They're easy. They're practical. They're things you can control. You're not going to have to get somebody else's permission generally to do something with these things. So the main audience is teachers, but I'm amazed at how many leaders in a variety of settings use it, whether it's principals who are trying to guide change in rigor and assessment and they want to learn from it and use it in professional development, instructional coaches, teacher leaders. All of those folks really like to take it because a lot of times when they are sitting down with teachers and the teachers say, we don't know what to do here, it serves as a resource for them. So teachers are probably the main one, but leaders find a lot of information in there they can use.
I totally understand that, especially because it could become kind of like your to help you with your planning and so forth and understand how to lead that change. It could become an integral part of it. So I could see that. So one of the things that I love about your books is that they are structured in an easy-to-read-and-use format. Rigor and assessment in the classroom is no different. You know, the title of the chapter says what is coming. You introduce the subject. You explain what needs explaining. And then you provide excellent examples of what it would look like so the teacher can put the content into use in the classroom the next day. You know, you also have reflective questions and then links to, and by the way, some incredible e-resources, which we'll talk about later. But the... you know, what I'd like you to do is talk about where the idea and concept for your formatting came from and what you're hoping to accomplish with this layout.
Well, this is honestly how I write all my books, whether they are for teachers or I've got three leadership books. They're all written the same way. And I think it goes back to something my dad taught me a long time ago. My dad was my first teacher. He's my best teacher. He still is. And he always taught me that if you really want someone to understand what you're saying, make sure you tell them what you're going to say, then say it, and then tell them what you said. Now, I don't exactly use that, but what I do is I tell you what I'm going to say, either in a heading or a title, then I say it, and then I tell you how to use it. So I really took his premise and adapted it. I am real big on graphics, meaning headings, boxes with information in them, or some kind of figure or graphic. The first thing I do when one of my new books gets here in the mail is I do what's called the flip test. And my husband just laughs at me with this because he knows I won't even talk to him about anything else until I've done this. I sit there and just flip it and make sure that every page that I can see is broken up, that there's not just straight text on any page. And he just thinks that's so funny, but I think it makes it so much more readable. I think tables make things more readable. I think summary charts help. And because I'm so passionate about making my material practical, then the format has come out of that.
Oh, excellent. Well, it's very practical and it's very usable. And this format, you can tell that it, you know, there's some experience speaking there because it's It just works very well, and it means that, you know, there's not so much writing that you get, you know, where was I, that type of thing. Instead, you get just enough, and then you give examples and you get into it, and it's good stuff. So, you know, and so with rigor and assessment in the classroom, it's divided into 10 chapters, and I'm going to read through those chapters. We're not going to be able to spend all the time today, but we've got a few of them we're going to talk about. Chapter 1 is best practices in rigor and assessment. Chapter 2 is planning for rigorous assessments. Chapter 3 is linking instruction and assessment to improve rigor. Chapter 4 is formative assessment for rigor. Chapter 5, rigorous summative assessments. Chapter 6, performance-based assessments to enhance rigor. Chapter 7, differentiated assessments to increase rigor for all students. Chapter 8, grading in a rigorous classroom. Chapter 9, the critical role of feedback in the rigorous classroom. And Chapter 10, working together to improve assessment in rigorous classrooms. Today, I'd like to get you to discuss a couple of the chapters. Let's look first at planning, that role that planning plays. In the introduction of Chapter 2, which is your chapter on planning, it's titled Planning for Rigorous Assessments, you note, but the most effective assessment comes from a detailed look at what we want to accomplish, then the development of a plan for accomplishing the goals. Could you talk about this?
Sure. I think the reason, and really once I did best practices, I started with planning, because I do think it's the first thing you have to do. And too often we jump right into the conversation of what, you know, what kinds of assessments are out there. Give me some ways to use assessment in the classroom. And planning really should be the first step. When I began my teaching, and I will freely admit that I needed to learn a lot, particularly when I began teaching, I did a lot of things wrong, and assessment was one of them. I pretty much just gave the assessment that came with the book, or gave the assessment another teacher was using. I really didn't think about assessment except to say, this is what I do when I finish teaching, and I put a grade on it, it goes in the grade book, and I've got to have enough grades to satisfy parents. And that's all I thought about with assessment. And some students did well, some students did not. And my summer job, because I taught a little bit of everything, but the bulk of my teaching was in a junior high, grades 7, 8, and 9. But my summer job was teaching 3, 4, and 5-year-olds how to swim. And that had been my college job, and I kept it. Ironically enough, and every teacher out there will appreciate this, I made more during my summer job than I made during my teaching career. Wow. And so, but I kept that job in the summer. And what I learned from that was that I was teaching them very differently, because my 3, 4, and 5-year-olds were very successful. But here was how I was teaching them. I knew what I needed them to be able to do in the water in order to move up to the next group. And so I totally planned my 2 weeks of instruction to make sure they could do those things. And I built it in sequence so that they could do those things and move up to the next class during the next cycle. And it hit me one day that I wasn't teaching my students during the year like that, that I had never considered that that's what I should do. So I began to look at assessment very differently. What did students need to show me they could do in order to have learned the material so that we could move on, whether that was on a test or a project or whatever. And it was just a totally different way of thinking about it. And later, interestingly enough, when I was a university professor, one of my department chairs told me, she said, the best way for you to teach a class, because I was, at that point, I was teaching pretty much new classes that I hadn't taught before. She said, the best thing you can do is sit down and write out your final exam first. And I was like, I don't understand. She said, if you write out your final exam, then you plan how you're going to get there. And I went, oh, I've done that before. And I think we don't always think about that.
No, I like that. That's great advice. By the way, I got to say that, because that's, you know, that's one of the things that I had a mentor who gave me that advice also. And when he showed me that, I was like, this makes sense.
Yes, sometimes it's just common sense and we don't think about it.
Yes. And a big part of what we're talking about here is, you know, planning is purposeful. it has to happen, and it doesn't just, you know, I over the years I've had colleagues who, you know, they were kind of proud of the thought that they could wing it. And I don't think you can ever really wing it if you're trying to make an impact on the kids' learning. You can wing it if you're just trying to, talk to them and babysit them for a day. But anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I present all the time, and I got to tell you, I don't wing it. Now, I don't necessarily have a written script, particularly when I'm doing my standard rigor. I've presented it hundreds of times, but I still, you know, I use my PowerPoint as an organizer. If I change something, I make a note of that. I really do pay attention. I mean, I know my book really well, but I sat down and made notes. Since you sent me the questions ahead of time, I made notes on them to make sure that I could fully answer your questions. I wouldn't dream of trying to wing this.
That's and that's why I don't understand why some think that they can do that in a class with you know, maybe 22 to 30 children who are, you know, coming up with all kinds of different ideas. So that's part of what makes it challenging. So the importance of planning is so much there, and I'm so glad that you had a chapter on that. So let's go into chapter 3, which is titled Linking Instruction and Assessment to Improve Rigor. And you start off this chapter with these words: rigorous instruction is integral to rigorous assessment. There are 3 times you will use assessments, and each has a particular type. Can you walk us through this chapter and the topic?
Sure, because again, I think one of the sort of fallacies we fall into is, okay, assessment is what happens at the end. It shows whether or not we've accomplished. But there's three times in the instructional process you want to assess students. You want to do it before the instruction, you want to do it during the instruction, and you want to do it after the instruction. So we tend to think about that being pre-assessment, formative assessment, and summative assessment. And, you know, we sort of know those terms, but I'm not sure, again, that we know the importance of them. So assessing students before the lesson is critical because we don't want to assume that they already know something or that they don't know something. And so probably the most common pre-assessment I see are KWL charts. You know, what do you know? What do you want to know? And then go back and what did you learn? And I like KWLs okay. They're not my favorite thing because you're calling on one student at a time, which means that not everybody is showing you what they know. And I think it sort of encourages a little bit of passive learning. You know, what do you know? Now I'm going to teach you. At least that's what I found with my students. So I'm not against them. I just didn't find them to be as effective as possible. So what I do like are things like, you know, putting up posters around the room. And each one has a word on them that's related to your subject. And the kids have post-it notes and they have to go around and write down something they know about that word. And then you use that to do your setup because you'll be able to tell how many students know something. Or an adaptation of the KWL. Again, I love post-it notes. Every student has a post-it note. They have to write down one thing they know. And it's okay to say, I don't know anything. And they get a second post-it note, one question they have. And you post them up on the wall or on the dry erase board, and the teacher organizes them by theme. And then, again, I can teach and say, well, you know, it's really interesting because, you know, today we're going to be learning about shapes. And we talked yesterday about circles. Well, today we're also going to talk about squares. And what's interesting is that five people said that that they knew that there were other shapes other than circles. And that's great because today we're going to be looking at them. And two people said circles don't have any corners. Well, the shape we're going to be talking about today does. And so what happens is when you do those kinds of pre-assessments, or you can use formal kinds of testing too, but you find out what students know and then you build on that. For upper grades, one of my favorite ones is anticipation guides. A middle school teacher I used to work with, she would do this where what she would do, students would work in pairs, and she would give them a table that had three columns. And in the first column, it had a Y and an N. In the second column, it had a statement. And then the third column was blank. So what happened was the students would work together to decide if each statement was true or not. So they would circle yes or no. Then they had to go find it in the text before she had taught it, figure out if they were right or wrong, and if they were wrong, they had to correct it. And so, again, then she used that sort of to spur the conversation. So pre-assessments really help kick off your lesson. Does that make sense?
Oh, yes, definitely makes sense.
And okay, so then we move to formative assessments, and those are just unbelievably critical because they are what keep you focused during the lesson. They're the assessments that say to you, hey, you're really doing well here and the students are learning. You know, green light, go for it. They're the yellow lights that say, hey, some of your students are getting it, but some of them aren't. So what are you going to do here? And then they're the red lights that say, boy, the students just aren't getting it. So figure out what you need to do. And so I think when we think about it that way, formative assessment is as much about our instruction as it is about student learning, because it's about taking that student learning but using it. We always talk about using it to inform instruction. James Popham, who does a lot of writing about assessment, says it should really be used to transform instruction. And I like that because it also tells you not just what to do, but if it's not working, that you need to do it a different way.
Excellent. You know, and it's pretty cool because you got into the formative assessment part of this as well. And I think that, you know, one of the things is pretty much understanding the role that these that assessments play in what they should be doing in preparing for working with the kids. Would you say so? Does that make sense?
Yeah. It's interesting because the other analogy I always use with formative assessment is a GPS or Google Maps. You know, if you think about how those work, they give you directions and you follow it. But if you take a wrong turn, it readjusts and gives you a different way to get back on track. And truthfully, that's sort of what formative assessment is. It says, here's where we're going to go. Now I'm going to check you periodically. Okay, we've gotten off track here. We need to come back to here. And that's a key part of differentiation also. But really focusing on that, it's hard because sometimes people will say, which of the three is the most important? And I have a tough time with that. But if I have to pick, I'm going to go with formative assessment because it's what really does tell me every single step of the way where my students are and what kind of progress they're making.
That's good stuff.
And then summative assessment, because I don't want to leave that out, is, you know, did the students learn what they should have learned? And what's interesting is that some of the practical things you can use for formative assessments can also be summative assessments. But we tend to think about summative assessments being projects, essays, you know, getting up and delivering a presentation, tests, you know, whether it's matching or multiple choice or true false, whatever. And so summative assessments are important. They're where you want students to end up. But again, what you've got to do is make sure you know that that matches what you're teaching and make sure the style is appropriate. And what I mean by that is that when I was teaching, that was before No Child Left Behind. And some of you are thinking, well, that was good. And it was, except that my state was one of the first states in the nation to implement standardized testing for promotion long before No Child Left Behind. And the thing was, I liked to teach in very creative ways. We did a lot of projects. We did a lot of activities. My tests tended to be open-ended. I liked that. And my students, because I was teaching remedial students, I taught in a tracked system, they responded well to that. Well, now all of a sudden, they're going to be promoted based on a multiple choice test. And it hit me that even though I knew my open-ended assessments were better, they didn't prepare students for the high-stakes test. And I was doing a disservice to them if I didn't do the type of testing that they were going to have to take later. And that doesn't mean I dumped all of my authentic assessments. It means I balanced them out. Because, again, it wouldn't be fair for my students to get to that high-stakes test and not have done multiple-choice questions and not know what to do with them. So I think with summative assessments, you've got to look at what you're measuring and how you're measuring.
Excellent. The I just think that sometimes what happens is that, kind of getting back to something we talked about before, that the planning role just keeps popping into my brain about how important it is. Because if you understand these assessments, then you understand where you and you're planning, then you're planning for these assessments and to be able to use them, like you said with that analogy about the formative assessment, you're like that GPS. You got to make adjustments at times when you realize the kids are getting it or not getting it, and especially the not getting it part. And, you know, if we're not doing anything about that and not paying attention to that, then we can be, you know, several miles off course if we were in the days with a compass and not readjusting.
Yes. And I am going to hijack your interview for just a couple of minutes.
Sure.
Because your next question is on formative assessment, which I think we've already talked about.
Yeah.
So I do want to talk about summative assessments for just a minute.
Go for it.
Because when I was a teacher, when it came to traditional testing, I just sort of thought I just had to take it as it was. And there are ways to take traditional tests and make them more rigorous. For example, if you're a teacher and you use true false tests and you think I'm getting ready to tell you you can't use them, I'm not going to tell you that. What I am going to tell you is that for students who are doing that, anytime they find a statement that is false, they should have to rewrite it as true, because rather than guessing, they're actually showing you what they understand. Matching tests, in many cases are just guesses. You know, I've got five words, I've got five definitions to match them to. So there's actually three levels of how you can increase the rigor of a matching test. So the first thing is, I can have my five words, but I can have eight definitions. So they really do have to filter to figure out which ones are right. Okay. The next thing I can do is have three columns. So maybe I've got scientists. And then the second column, which again, I've got five scientists. The second column is going to have seven or eight. And that's inventions. And the third column, which again has seven or eight, has time periods. So I have to be able to match all three. And for my really strong advanced students, my gifted students, you're trying to get into some differentiation, I'm going to have them do the three columns, but then they have to create a fourth column. They have to come up with a theme on their own and put the correct answers in. And so do you see how that takes something that's very basic, but ratchets up for all levels of students?
Oh, definitely. They, you know, I think that, and what's interesting is what you're describing there, because, and I want to go back just to the true-false for a minute.
Yeah.
The whole idea of having to make the statement true eliminates, you're going to know whether they know it or not.
Right.
As opposed to lucky guess. And I think that in itself just speaks so incredibly to what you're talking about. Because, yeah, I don't know what, you know, and I have some friends who just spend all their time guessing on multiple choice. It's like, you know, it's like, I don't think they really knew any of it. And they just figured, well, I'll take a look at my chances here. And anything that you can do to make it where you actually are using the, you know, the assessment is helping you understand what they know and don't know, is going to be so helpful if you approach it that way, I would think.
Yeah, I think so. And again, my approach in all my books is I'm not going to tell you what you're doing is wrong, not unless you're hurting kids, but I'm not going to tell you wrong to use true-false test. I'm just going to tell you, hey, you can make it better by doing this. And I think that too often teachers find themselves in situations, whether it's professional development or doing a book study, where the person is just hammering them for all the things they're doing wrong. You know, I believe passionately that teachers and leaders are doing a great job. The majority of them are doing a great job working hard to make a difference with kids. And so I'm not about to come in and tell you you're doing a bad job. What I am going to do is say, hey, I've got some ideas that may help you be even better if you'll try them.
No, that's awesome. Because the better we can get at assessments and using them correctly and helping us with instruction, the better we're going to do at helping to further the kids' understanding of the content, I would think. So
yes.
So let's talk about chapter 8, which jumps into the topic that can really set a meeting on fire. I mean, this one, as soon as I saw it in there, I hate to tell you this, but I actually, once I saw this as one of your chapters, I went there first. I said, I got to read this. All right. And then I went back and read everything else. And that's grading. That's what chapter 8's about. It's grading. In this section, one of your think about it's asks, what is your purpose for grading? Can you talk about this question and then dive into the purpose for including this chapter?
Oh, yeah. And you're right. Grading is one of those hot topics. And in my very first book, which was back in 2005, it was Classroom Motivation from A to Z, I had a chapter on grading. And I was doing some research. And a big piece that jumped out to me is this concept of what is your purpose? And I thought, okay, well, the purpose of grading is assessment and evaluation. You want to find out what students know and be able to put a number or a letter on that and use that to tell the students and tell the parents where they are. That's just what I assumed it was. And when I was reading some of the research on it, because even though my books are pretty practical, they are research founded. It talked about all the other reasons people grade. That they grade to determine placements. You know, you can, if you're making a certain grade, you can get put in the gifted section. I had that with my niece. They used a test, but they also used grades. Grades are used for recommendations, whether it's to college or to a special program. A friend of mine, her daughter was not accepted into a summer STEM academy because the teacher didn't recommend her because her grades were B's instead of A's. So we use them for those purposes. We also, and I had not thought about this, but once I read it, I was like, oh, yeah, we do this. Many people use them for motivation as extrinsic motivators, both as a carrot and a stick. So I want you to do this for me. Let's take homework. I want you to do this for me. So your reward, if you do your homework, your carrot, is a good grade. On the other hand, if you don't do it, it's the stick. You get a bad grade. And it never, I guess it just never occurred to me that that grades could be used that way. And then I thought about an example when I was a high school student. And I'm going to share this, and I know that some of you are going to go, the teacher did the right thing. Okay, I will give you that. I don't agree, but I will give you that. So when I was in high school, my dad taught at a college, and I wanted to be a teacher. I have always wanted to be a teacher. And my dad chaired the Department of Health and Physical Education, and every spring he taught a course for physical education majors to teach them how to coordinate, plan, and manage taking students on a field trip. And because it was physical education, they did a ski trip. Well, one day they would leave like at 6 a.m. and get back in about 8 p.m. So he asked me to go with him. I was a junior. And he wrote a note. We didn't hide anything. He explained what was going on. He made sure the principal knew. He made sure every one of my teachers knew. And several of them said, you know, this is technically not an excused absence. And we sort of got that, but, you know, we thought we had a valid reason for it. So anyway, I go, had a great time, learned a lot, come back. And at the end of the 9 weeks, I made solid grades in everything. I had earned those grades, except in my economics course. And on the back of the report card, he wrote, Barbara would have earned an A, but she took a day off to go skiing. And so she made a B. And the thing is, I have always struggled with that. On the one hand, yeah, technically that was the policy. But on the other hand, you know what? That showed, that didn't show at all what I had learned. That had nothing to do with that because I had made up the work. I had scored well on the test. It only changed because I missed a day. And is that a fair purpose of grading, or was he trying to punish me for something he didn't like, which there were some other circumstances that would lead me to believe that? And so what are we doing with grading, with our purpose of grading?
Yeah, that is, I think a lot of times the classroom teacher has not thought about that. And the building administrator needs to be thinking about why we grade also, so they can lead that discussion. I mean, why do we grade? And if you don't understand it, you end up doing goofy things like combining behaviors with academics, mm-hmm. so that then you take away from someone's academic grade for a behavior, which they're not the same thing. And, you know, it's one of those things that just like, you know, I'll come to your side there with this. I, you know, one of the things that I don't like about what happened there is that if you could do it and not be in school, then obviously you could do it. You didn't have to be there. And I've had this discussion before with a classroom teacher who wanted to give a kid a B for not being, it had to do with the grade on a final is what it had to do with. And the kid was able to knock out a high B and had missed all these days of school. You know, it's a lot of stuff that the kid had going on. It wasn't just that he was skipping school, but the teacher kept trying to knock his grade down just simply because of not being there for so many days. And I said, look, he was able to do this without being in your class, and you designed the test. What does that tell you about his abilities? And, you know, and he just wanted to downgrade the letter just because, you know, of something that he said in his syllabus. And I'm like, no, this can't happen here.
And what happens is the purpose really does drive decisions that we aren't even thinking about. So let's take homework, because that's also whether you count homework or not is right. Very controversial. Well, I know teachers who believe that grades should be based on what students show you they know in the classroom, because parents will do the work at home. Okay.
Right.
So I understand that. But if you believe that, then that means you're not going to grade homework. You may still have them do it, but you're not going to grade it. Well, then I have other people who say, well, if they just try, they should get a passing grade. Okay, so you're telling me the purpose of grading is to grade effort as well as quality. Okay, again, I'm okay with that if that's what you're telling me, but did you make that decision? And are you really just saying, I feel sorry for this student, therefore I want to give them a better grade? Or, and this one, I have to tell you, this one's one of my biggest pet peeves. And I did it when I was a new teacher too. And that's when we grade based on completion rather than quality. So as long as they do it, then it gets an A. Now, I'm not talking about, you know, homework that you're just checking off that they attempted it. I'm not talking about that. But you give them something to do. Like the example I use in the book was a teacher, they were studying the Wild West, and the kids had to pick somebody from the Wild West and do a wanted poster. And everything that it was graded, the rubric that was given to them was like 10 points for putting your name on the paper. 10 points for having it on an 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper, 10 points for having the title. You know, it was all just as long as you do it, nothing about the quality. I could do a lousy job as long as it was neat and pretty. And, you know, if what you want to do is grade neat and pretty, then you just need to tell them it's that so they don't worry about quality. And so I just don't think that a lot of times we think about our purpose for grading. I think we take it for granted.
Oh, so much. I so agree with you. That's something that I think the teacher has to come to an understanding of why they grade, so that then they question anything needing a grade. Because if you don't question it, you know, if you don't understand why you're grading, then, you know, there are some things that you got to decide whether they even need a grade or not. And if you don't know why you grade, then you're not going to have those conversations with yourself, I guess is my point. So,
yeah. And not everything has to be graded. I mean, that's a whole different discussion, but I would want to take away to be, if you're a new teacher out there listening, you don't have to grade everything. You do need to grade some things. Students need to know where they are. Parents need to know where they are. Don't end up report card time only having 3 grades, but you don't have to grade every single thing the students do.
That's great, especially because if you can get them out of the habit of thinking that everything needs a grade, which you can do that if you just approach it that way. You say, nope, not everything's going to get a grade. It's about doing, and I give you feedback, and we move from there. I think that's just so critical to what needs to happen when it comes to grading, is that the teacher coming to that understanding also is that I don't need to have, 100 points worth of grades on certain things. So, but I just used a word that it would be a perfect segue into the next question, which has to do with feedback. Your chapter 9 is the critical role of feedback in the rigorous classroom. You introduce the reader to the link between student motivation and feedback. Could you expound upon this?
Oh, sure. Now, you need to know that my bias is that I think you can take almost every single classroom issue related to discipline. I think you can take every instructional issue, every assessment issue, and link it back to motivation, because I think motivation just weaves through everything. Students are motivated. You know, a lot of times we think students aren't motivated, but let me tell you, every student in every classroom is motivated. They're just not motivated by what we want them to be motivated by.
Yes.
And that is very different. And so there's really 2 aspects to student motivation: value and success. Students are motivated when they see value in something. They are motivated when they feel successful. And value, you're probably thinking, oh yeah, I try to do that. I try to make real life connections. Well, relevance is a part of value, but I will tell you this, there are times that I've had to teach something and there really wasn't any real life value to it. It pretty much was, I was teaching it because it was on the test. So there are actually 3 ways students see value. They see value in relevance. They also see value in activities. They're more motivated when they're doing something than when they're sitting and getting. And then they're motivated by their relationship with us. If they have a positive relationship with us, then they're more likely to be motivated and to try what we're asking them to do. So you've got value and success. So when you look at feedback as it relates to those 2, if I am, let's take something basic. You have written something. We're in a writing class. You've written something, and I'm going to give you feedback, whether it's verbal or written. the first thing I'm doing by giving you feedback more than just okay or a check mark, when I give you written feedback or verbal feedback, I'm building a relationship with you, particularly if I'm careful not to just be critical. I'm all about it's okay if you want to criticize, but you also need to say something positive. I heard a guy speaking a couple of weeks ago, and he said that you always should end with something positive because that's really what people remember. And what I always tried to do was a sandwich. Positive, what they needed to fix, and then positive again. And so when I do that, I'm building a relationship. I'm also helping you feel successful. And as a part of success, I'm not just patting you on the head and saying, good job. I'm helping you be even more successful. If my feedback is, you know, could you give me a practical example here? Or this sounds really good, but if you were going to take this home and read it to your brother, what would you change? Then I'm building in that relevance and I'm building in the activity. So it makes a difference when you think about motivation. And the same thing's true. Let's say that you're doing a math word problem and you've made a mistake and skipped a step. So if I'm talking you through that, and I may be doing this as a whole class even, but if I'm talking you through that, I'm really focusing on success, not what's wrong, but how can we learn from it? I'm building that relationship because you know that I care enough about you to want you to be successful. And if nothing else, I'm making it relevant because you're expected to do this right now, and I'm helping you figure out how to do it. And we're doing it not by me just telling you what to do. I'm helping you do it. So I've got that activity. So everything we do with feedback can either positively or negatively impact student motivation.
That's excellent. There's so much to learn from just that little bit that you just shared with us right there about how you should plan and how you should make up your class, what you should spend a little time on. Thank you very much. One of the things I want to make sure that I talk about is that you have some cool resources. And by the way, that's an understatement because they're amazing resources that come with the book. You have them inside the chapters and you have them linked electronically. So would you describe these and why they were included and what you were thinking about as you did these?
Well, that's one of the fun things I get to do when the book is done. My editor and I sit down and look at the finished book and say, okay, which of the tools are most practical? Which ones could somebody take and really run with it? And so we try to pick between 10 and 15. I was just counting. There's 13 in this book. And so there's more than that in the book, but these are the ones we pick out and post. And my publisher has them on their website. I have them on my website. And let me say this, I do this for every single book. And so every one of my books has these activity templates, these tools that are posted. So if you go to my website, which is www.BarbaraBlackburnOnline.com, and if you can't find it that way, just Google Barbara Blackburn and Rigor, and I pop up. A fact that my 20-year-old stepson is quite impressed by. anyway, if you go to the website, go to free. I mean, it's real easy. Go to free and go to book activity templates and just pick a book. And there's all of these. So, for example, in this one, there are some writing conference questions. There's questions for self-assessments. There's a couple of rubrics, peer feedback charts. One of my favorite ones is a math one. And it's called Understanding Math Better. And this is when you want students to rework math problems. Let's say on the test, you're going to have them rework the ones they missed for partial credit. And so what this math reflection does is not only do they have to rework it, they have to tell you why they missed it in the first place. And there are choices given. So I skipped a step. I didn't understand the problem. I tried to finish too quickly. And so they circle why they missed it to start with. And then they have to write why I know I have it right now. And it's really cool because as a teacher, I can start looking for patterns. So if the student is always skipping a step, then we need to slow down. If I've got out of my 25 who missed this question, 18 of them said they didn't understand the question, I got to go back and look at that question. So it's really cool. And you can use that without the book. So Again, you just go to the website, go to free, and go to book downloads. And there's tons of other stuff. There's over 100 resources on the website. All of them are free. You have copyright permission to use all of them, and you do not have to register.
That's so excellent. That's what I love, is it's free is free. This is there's no little fine print here that you've got to give me something in exchange for. It's right there with your book and the chapters, and you can use it to help you do what you need to do in that class. So thank you for including such incredible resources, because they're easy to use, and this is part of what makes the book so user-friendly, because you can read the section, you can read the chapters, you can read it, and then here's some resources, which means I can put it in my plans. I could read it this weekend. I could put in my plans this weekend, and then I could put it into action on Monday morning. And, you know, and you could do the same thing on a Wednesday night and put it in action on Thursday night, simply because you got the resources right there, which is so
yes,
cool.
Yes, you can.
That's what I love. So it's awesome that you've done that. So as we're finishing up, if a listener would like to reach out to you and learn more, what would be the best way?
Really contacting me through my website. And again, just to say it one more time slowly, it's BarbaraBlackburnOnline.com. So you've got the free materials, but there's also information. There's a contact me. On the contact me is my Google phone number that'll send you straight to my cell phone. There's information about all of my books. There's a section just for leaders. There are links to, oh my goodness, so many things I can't even go through them. And there's a section on my professional development. And, you know, you've seen me come and do on-site professional development.
Yes.
And I certainly love doing that with both teachers, and I do some leadership training also. But I also do a lot of Skypes and Google Hangouts and webinars. And one piece I've been doing lately with the publication of this book is I do specialized training on assessing your assessments. How can you determine if your assessments are rigorous or not, and what can you do to improve them? And I've got a model where I can assess them. I've got a model where I can train you to assess them. I can train a group of trainers who can do that, and that can all be done online, because these days with budgets the way they are, it's really important to try to minimize some cost. So the assessment piece has really been popping up lately. So if you go to the website and go to professional development, there are all those choices there.
Excellent. Thank you so much for explaining that, because that's one of the things I was going to ask you, is because you do come out and you do training and stuff like this. And if they were interested in that, they could also, through the contact page, because you can ask questions there, can't you? Not just send an email.
Oh, yeah, you can do. You can pretty much contact me about anything you want to. I had somebody one time contact me and say their grandson was struggling in school, and what recommendations did I give to him? So
nice.
I try to answer everybody.
Nice. One of the things that I will be doing is that any links, I'll put them in my show notes. So anybody listening right now, you don't have to, you know, quickly pull over or do whatever. I will have it in my show notes. All you got to do is go there and link to it, and you'll be able to go contact Barbara. So where can someone get a copy of Rigor and Assessment in the Classroom?
They can get it from Routledge, my publisher. Of course, it's on Amazon also, but my publisher, I would be remiss if I didn't tell you to get it from them first. What I will do is I will send you a special link that goes to a landing page with Routledge, and it will give you 20% off any of my books.
Nice.
And so that would be a nice little discount. And that way they can link directly to that. You know, you can always go to my website and it links you over. And if a school is interested or a district's interested in doing a book study, contact me and I'll put you in touch with my publisher, because they will definitely work with you on a discount for book orders.
Excellent. Thank you so much for sharing that and putting that together. I look forward to sharing that link out with my listeners. I got last two questions here. If you were given the chance to talk with 100 brand new teachers, and these are teachers who haven't started teaching yet, what advice would you give them about rigor in the classroom?
Okay, my first one is not specifically about rigor, but I wish somebody had told me this. You are going to make mistakes, and don't beat yourself up too much over them. Learn from them and move on. But you are going to make lots of mistakes, and that's normal, because nobody ever told me that. And so that scared me. Now, in terms of rigor, what I would say is don't try to make it too fancy. Don't feel like you've got to create this whole new lesson that is rigorous. You can implement rigor in a lot of different ways, like we talked about with the true-false test. You can do it by, instead of just having students tell you what a word means. They get together in groups and write riddles, which requires them to push to higher levels of thinking. So you don't have to do anything real fancy. Just look for quality suggestions on the internet. And I guess my caution there too would be, there's a lot of stuff on the internet, and you will absolutely use those resources because it's your only way to survive. But you need to be careful because there's a lot of junk. So look for quality resources and just implement it in what you're doing.
That's excellent. And great advice. 'Cause I mean, just taking the one part about all the junk that's out there. Sometimes adults are just as bad as kids, where they don't evaluate the quality of what it is that they've taken a look at, and it might be wrong.
Right.
So good stuff. So the last question is, let's switch gears and talk about principals. What advice would you give principals who believe that the academic rigor in their school needs addressing?
Well, there's really two parts. The first is they need to identify what needs to be addressed more than just saying rigor. Is it instruction? Is it planning? Is it questioning? Is it assessment? So for example, if they're not sure, one of the first things I have them do, and a lot of times I go in and do this with principals, is we do walkthroughs only looking at rigor. Don't look at behavior, don't look at classroom management, just look at the rigor. And one of the biggest things I see in classrooms is, and it's a mistake that sometimes principals make, is they know to look for whether or not the teacher is asking higher order questions, but they forget to look at whether or not the student gives a higher order answer. So you'll have a high level question and the student gives a really basic answer and the teacher takes it and moves on. Well, that's not rigor. So looking at that, are our assessments measuring what we want them to measure? Are they pretty basic? Are they one word answers? Are they the who, what, when, where, why, and how? Are they cause and effect and inferencing, which is good, but it's really not rigorous. And so looking at those kinds of things. So first, you've got to determine what is it that's not rigorous. Then you have to figure out, what am I going to do about it? Do my teachers need some outside assistance? Because a lot of times you do. Do I need professional development so that I can know what to do? What is going to be the best way for us to approach it? And in approaching it, don't go, okay, we're going to change everything. Figure out how you're going to weave it in. And so for principals, I would tell you, go to look at those free resources on the website, because Rigor in Your School, a toolkit for leaders, is up there. And a lot of the tools are up on there for you to use. And the school-wide book is on how do you impact 7 areas of school change: culture, ownership and shared vision, managing data, professional development, advocacy, shared accountability, and structures to sustain success. So, there's some things on there for you that you could grab, because in the book, there's things like, how do you do a culture audit? How do you figure out what it is about your culture that's working and not working? But from an overall perspective, don't try to change everything overnight. Figure out what needs to be done. Don't try to change it all overnight.
I think that's great advice, because that trying to change it all overnight is something that is quite tempting. It's a path that's quite tempting to follow down, to travel down. So, it's because you just think, we got all this limited time, so we got to do it now. Well, Barbara, thank you so much for joining me today. I enjoyed catching up with you and learning about rigor and assessment in the classroom. And I know that we'll be talking again soon, because you got another one coming out soon. Do you want to say anything about that book that's getting ready to come out?
Well, I'm actually going to tell you about 2, Steve. I'm going to give you a couple of surprises.
Nice.
One, I told you that in March, the 3rd edition of Rigor's Not a Four-Letter Word is coming out. But I'm also very excited to have co-written a book with a former colleague of mine called Rigor in the RTI and MTSS Classroom. And it is being co-published by the Council for Exceptional Children. So what I've promised Steve is to see if I can get Brad to come on with me and the two of us talk about that. And then, just a little bit further out, in July, I just turned in Rigor in the Differentiated Classroom.
Nice. This is, do you actually, just function 24 hours a day working on this? I mean, you're cranking these out, man.
No. My husband will attest to the fact that I sleep like 10 hours a night. He says, oh my gosh, how long you sleep. But I love to write. And so when I'm not on the road, I write. And it's just perfect. I have a nice little office up above our garage, and I come up here and my cat sits at my feet and I write. So that's what I do when I'm at home.
That's excellent. Well, thank you very much. Look forward to those coming out. Look forward to you talking. Look forward to talking with you again very soon. So thank you, Barbara. Thanks for being here.
Okay, thank you.
Take care. Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is a proud member of the Education Podcast Network. Podcasts for educators, podcasts by educators. The opinions expressed on Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 are those of the guests and host. Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is intended to share ideas, advice, and suggestions for classroom teachers and school administrators. Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is produced for educational purposes. Thanks for listening. We hope to share it with your friends.